KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Former South African President Nelson Mandela is on life support in a Pretoria hospital. Coming up this hour, we're going to talk with one South African native about the man and his legacy and what he has done to shape modern South Africa. Closer to home, state lawmakers have come oh so close, but they still have no budget deal. The clock continues to tick. Joining us with an update on the progress of this second special legislative session is Jordan Schrader. He covers state politics for the Tacoma News Tribune. And Jordan, are we keeping you away from a last-minute agreement?
Oh, they're always about to have a last-minute agreement.
It sounds as if the houses have agreed on a budget number, $33.8 billion. Am I right about that?
Well, we're hearing some reports about what the about the possibility that there might be a vote as early as today. That's just coming in. But as of yesterday, leaders were saying they might vote as early as Friday. And they've come to agreement on the broad strokes of the budget, including $1 billion for basic education to comply with a court ruling and a plan that apparently would not raise tuition on college students next year. They're still haggling over some of the details.
Well, what are some of those details that they're haggling over?
Well, oddly enough, one is a study of how much fish people eat. This is something that's been percolating for a while in Olympia as the Department of Ecology tries to figure out that question and set rules for water pollution accordingly. And this has worried some industries and local governments, and including Boeing. And Boeing is trying to get a study done to that would effectively would delay this for a while they study this further.
Huh. And they couldn't have done this separate from the budget, or is this part of the budget?
Right. You would think that this could be a separate bill, but what happens is a lot of things get buried into the budget, little provisos that really have very little to do other than do with it, other than they spend a little money to do the study. So right now they're arguing over those provisos, but some of that seems to be they seem to be coming on a deal to a deal on a lot of those.
So it's possible that they could vote on this budget and avoid the government partial government shutdown, which is set to begin on Monday.
It's set to begin Monday, and they'd like very much to let state workers know on Friday before they leave for the weekend that they will have a job when they return on Monday. We'll see. They've missed other deadlines, including the ones to notify state workers and the ones and one yesterday that required them to send out notifications to a lot of clients who get state services like food aid for immigrants. So they've missed a lot of deadlines, and we'll see. But I think they'll make their June 30th deadline, at least.
You know, of the many things that are going to be affected by this shutdown, if there is one, it seems that the state justice system and prisons are really going to be hit hard. Or am I misreading it?
Well, they'll certainly have to operate on reduced staff. The big issue seems to be that a lot of offenders would be unsupervised who are out of prison, who are effectively on parole. And a lot of the people who supervised those folks would no longer have a job temporarily if there was a government shutdown. Again, that seems unlikely at this point. But prisons and the Special Commitment Center and Western State Hospital, for example, they would all go on operating, albeit probably on reduced staff.
We're talking with Jordan Schrader, who covers state politics for the Tacoma News Tribune. Another big failure, I suppose, for the governor was the transportation package went to a vote and was defeated probably by about 3-vote margin.
Yeah, really, pretty much by one vote. They needed 50, and they got up to 49 until one supporter changed his vote to allow him to ask for a revote, and he's done that. And so they can have a revote at any time, and it might be as soon as today. That's tax package that would raise the gas tax by 10.5 cents and raise a number of fees on drivers, also would allow local governments to raise more taxes and fees. And the goal would be to fund a lot of road projects and road maintenance along with transit, buses, ferries. And that ran into some opposition in the House, including from some people who just think it's not going to go anywhere in the Senate, so why bother?
So they just voted no?
Some people in rural areas who don't have, some Democrats especially in rural areas who don't have projects in their district voted no. They lost six Democrats on that vote, and then only one Republican joined them, Hans Zeiger. He's from Puyallup, and he has a major project in his district, State Route 167. So people are doing the math about how much their constituents would provide in gas tax and fees and how much they would get in roads, and the math didn't add up yesterday. We'll see if it changes.
This transportation package, the governor has hinted that if it doesn't pass, that he's going to call lawmakers back for a third session, which I think everybody hopes doesn't happen. But I'm curious, is it the prospect of raising taxes, or is it this Columbia River crossing that we keep hearing about between Vancouver, Washington, and Portland, Oregon, that are really the hang-ups for this bill?
Well, in the Senate, the Columbia River crossing seems to be a big hang-up, but you also hear people just simply saying people can't afford to pay more taxes. This is people, you know, leaders of the Senate. Others saying, well, look, once we finish the budget, we're going to get out of town, and there just won't be time to give this the good look that it needs. The governor has said that he wants them to stick around, and they could stick around to the middle of next month in their current session, even without calling a third special session. So that's a ways off. But talking to the Senate Majority Leader, Rodney Tom, yesterday, he said, look, we need to get out of town. We're going to accomplish our goals, which is a budget and a capital construction budget, and get out of town, and there's no need to stick around. And you don't want us doing a transportation package on no sleep for the last 5 days.
Well, they had a lot of days before the last 5 days.
They sure did. And the transportation measure's been around since the beginning of session in basically the form it is now, give or take half a cent and a few details. So they've had plenty of time to look at it.
It's interesting. This is a little bit of an aside, but I was talking to my boss who wondered why there's not citizen outrage at the length of time that it's taking lawmakers to come to any agreement.
Well, in some ways, this is the same as it ever was, and people are probably kind of inured to it. This is the eighth special session in the last 3 years, and I think probably there is some good reason that people don't necessarily need to get outraged about it. There's a lot of complicated work to be done, and there's sort of this arbitrary 105-day limit in the Constitution on the work that they do down here. So, they have a lot to do, and when divided power between Republicans and Democrats this year and a new governor, you can kind of understand why it might take a while. Not that that's not infuriating for people who are down here and the taxpayers who have to fund it.
Well, that's another question, but there is something that got done yesterday, an impaired driving bill passed.
Right. That's not an issue I've been covering closely, but the Senate passed this, and it could be taken up and passed by the House today. It's been watered down a bit from where it was before, so it's now less costly and less restrictive, but it does strengthen the penalties on drunk drivers.
You are based out of Tacoma, so I'm not sure if you can answer this question or not, but one thing that a lot of King County politicians and observers are waiting for in this transportation budget is something that you mentioned briefly, which is a local taxing option. That is, for King County, something that will fund our bus system. And if it's not passed, they're preparing for massive cuts. And I know Dow Constantine, the current King County executive, was more incensed than I've ever seen him in talking about the ability to have local taxing authority. Is there a possibility that that could be separated out of the big transportation bill and passed?
I don't think so, because I think there are people who want this big package statewide, and they think that if they pass something that will sort of satisfy King County and maybe some of the ring suburban counties, that there goes the momentum for a statewide package. And so to some extent, this local authority, local taxing authority for King and Pierce and Snohomish, this is leverage for a bigger statewide package, and if they let that go on its own, who knows when the bigger statewide one will go up.
You mentioned with a divided government, sometimes business takes a little longer, and the fact that we do have a new governor. I don't know. Well, I'm going to ask you anyways. I don't know whether you can rate him or not, but how effective do you think he's been at advocating and lobbying for his ideas and his policies?
Well, I wouldn't rate him yet. I think it's still incomplete, but he's been sort of a different style than Governor Gregoire in that she was sort of seen as a deal maker and somebody who would get the warring parties in a room and hammer out a deal. He has clearly taken the side of the House, which is controlled by Democrats. And to be fair to him, for most of Governor Gregoire's time in office, she had Democrats in both the House and Senate. So you can understand why maybe she would play the peacemaker, whereas he's now got Republicans basically controlling the Senate. So he's clearly picked a side, and so I guess you'll have to grade him on how many of his priorities get done. Transportation is a big one that's looking like it's flagging, but could come out at the last minute. DUI is one that he does want. But some of his other proposals early in session, including tax breaks and other economic development issues, didn't go anywhere. And the tax breaks that he wanted to close and some of the taxes that he wanted to extend, the beer tax, B&O tax, that didn't happen. The Democrats basically gave up on almost all of their taxes except for a couple of things that are basically addressing court decisions that changed how changed the tax code.
And just a last question. How much have these special sessions cost we, the taxpayers?
Well, we don't have a total yet, but it's fairly minimal in that there's very few people who are here every day. It's the, you know, 10 budget negotiators or so. But certainly there is a cost. They have staff here that continues to work. Legislators, the rank and file legislators, do come down when they need to take a vote. So there's some cost there. My suspicion is the bigger cost is going to be all the time that these agencies are spending preparing people for a government shutdown. That's going to end up they're going to end up spending a lot of money notifying people and then potentially notifying people again, sort of never mind when this doesn't materialize.
Well, we'll be watching, and I know you will be as well. Thank you so much for bringing us up to date.
Yeah, thanks for having me here.
That was great. Jordan Schrader covers state politics for the Tacoma News Tribune. This is Weekday on KUOW.
Sixty-six degrees in Seattle. It is cloudy, and the National Weather Forecast says we should expect it to turn partly sunny later, with a continuing chance of showers and a high of 72. Now, starting tomorrow on Friday, we're looking at mostly sunny days and temperatures up in the upper 70s to low 80s all the way through Wednesday.
Support for KUOW comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Visitor Center, extending an invitation to experience stories of making a difference with StoryCorps beginning June 27th. Learn more at visitorcenter.gatesfoundation.org.
It's 10:20. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A bit later this hour, murder. Well, sort of. We're going to find out what they did back in the golden age of radio to try to protect kids from depictions of violence on the radio. That's 20 minutes away.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Former South African President Nelson Mandela is in critical condition still at a hospital in Pretoria. He is on life support, although current South African President Jacob Zuma says Mandela is comfortable and well-tended. The government hasn't revealed much more information about his health. Many South Africans view Nelson Mandela as a beloved family elder, so his passing will be more significant than the death of a politician or government statesman. Joining us now to talk about the man and the role he played in shaping modern South Africa is Robert Taylor. He's the former dean of St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Seattle. He was born and raised in South Africa. Robert, thanks for joining me today.
It's wonderful to be with you, Marcy. Thank you.
You grew up in the apartheid era in your homeland, and I was wondering when you first remember hearing about Nelson Mandela.
Well, you know, I heard about him when I was quite young, and it didn't mean much to me until I entered my teen years, and in my mid-teens, I began to be very aware of the realities of apartheid, and started to learn a lot about Mandela. The white apartheid government presented him as, they labeled him as the sort of arch-communist, being a label for anyone who is in opposition to the apartheid system. And he was really presented as a demonic figure. It was a treasonable offense to own his writings, to display his image in public. I mean, that's how scared they were of this man who'd been imprisoned for, you know, at that point, probably close to 15 years or so. And I remember, as a college student, I worked as a freelance correspondent for a shortwave radio station, which actually beamed stories into South Africa from neighboring African countries, given the tight state control of media in South Africa during those years. And my work took me to neighboring countries, and I remember smuggling in copies of Mandela's writings and being incredibly nervous about that, but soaking them up and not understanding why the vision that he painted of a South Africa in which all of its citizens belonged and counted and were granted equal freedom, equal rights, and had a democracy. Why this was such a frightening idea? I mean, it seemed to me like the most appealing possible vision for the country.
Robert, I'm going to interrupt you for one second because we're getting a weird sort of demonic feedback in this conversation. So what we're going to do is take a break and rejoin you when we get you on a better phone line, okay?
Great.
Okay, Robert Taylor, former dean of St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Seattle, and we'll continue our conversation about him and Nelson Mandela in about 10 minutes when we get a better phone line.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Now we're heading back again into the golden age of radio. During radio's golden age, there's a lot of entertainment directed at kids. No surprise, it's just like today. And just like today, there were parents' groups that were worried about what kids were being exposed to. What were they so afraid of, Katie Sewell?
Well, they were crunching the numbers, Steve, like they still do today. At the time, it was estimated that 1,500 murders happened a week on the radio.
Suppose we just start talking about murder. Maybe something interesting will come out. Now tell me, could you kill?
I don't think so.
Maybe you could. Here. Here's a loaded gun. Take it.
Oh.
That's it. Now, point it at me.
That was Raymond Burr. That's Perry Mason. What the heck is he doing back there telling people to kill?
That was an episode of Suspense.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. To protect children from violence and bad messages, eventually some strict guidelines were issued. Among those many, many, many guidelines were things like this. Disrespect for the law must be avoided. Cruelty, greed, and selfishness must not be presented as worthy motivations. And the hero must be portrayed as intelligent and morally courageous. Of course, Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy, fit the bill.
Wave the flag for Hudson High, boys. Show them how we stand. Ever shall our team be champions, known throughout the land.
Wheaties, breakfast of champions, bring you the thrilling adventures of Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy.
Jack Armstrong.
Jack Armstrong, he was a football star, hero of Hudson High School. His name was supposedly inspired by the bicep on the Arm & Hammer baking soda box.
Really?
While the writer was looking for an idea of what to call him. The show's writer, Robert Hardy Andrews, was told to make a soap opera for kids. And that was his mission, and he succeeded. Jack Armstrong, All-American Boy, was the longest-running adventure program on the air, starting in 1933 and remaining on the air until 1951.
Wow. That's weekday longevity.
That is. It was a long-running show. The show followed the adventures of Jack and his friends and Uncle Jim, who takes Jack all over the world to complete very important missions, like retrieving uranium, for example, and escaping the pirates that want to steal that uranium from you.
There, Uncle Jim. The box of uranium is all lashed down on deck.
We may have to cut those lashings in a hurry, Jack. If the black shark tries to board us, that uranium goes overboard the instant they set foot on our deck.
Uncle Jim, I have a corking idea, if it'll work.
What is it, Jack?
We can cross this stretch of reef, but the black shark can't. She draws too much water. She'll pile up if she tries to.
I follow you, Jack.
That is Corkin.
What a smart young man. He was a good moral example. And he was also great publicity for a sponsor, Wheaties. No one actually had paid much attention to Wheaties before Jack Armstrong came along. Charles Flynn, who played the role of Jack Armstrong for the majority of the show, was asked by a reporter in his 80s if he was still eating his Wheaties. And his answer was, "You bet I do. Put my kids through school." Originally, Wheaties was sponsoring a different show that was featuring a young hero named Skippy. But Skippy ran into an unfortunate PR disaster. On the air, Skippy was trying to find a friend that was abducted at the same time this was happening in real life.
The message that shocks the world comes in on the police teletype and that brings into instant action the entire facilities of the nation's law enforcing agencies. The crime was committed by means of a ladder placed against the house. The baby was stolen, dressed in his little sleeping suit. By two men and a woman, we believe.
The abduction of Lindbergh's baby made Skippy seem rather insensitive that he was, you know, making a lighter adventure show about trying to find an abducted friend. And the show was very quickly canceled in 1933. And that made way for the creation of Jack Armstrong, which, believe it or not, is in the Radio Hall of Fame. And it was inducted in 1989.
I believe it. I mean, come on, that's a long-running
show. Hey, it's a long-running show. Now, for girls, there was Little Orphan Annie.
Who's the little chatterbox, the one with pretty auburn locks? Whom do you see? It's Little Orphan Annie. She and Sandy make a pair. They never seem to have a care. Cute little she, this Little Orphan Annie.
You know what always freaked me out about Orphan Annie was that no pupils.
No pupils. Yeah, I actually read somewhere that people didn't really like that about that comic strip. Rather, she wasn't fueled by Wheaties, though, like Jack Armstrong. She was fueled by Ovaltine.
It's 5:45 now, the time when you hear about Orphan Annie's adventures and all about Ovaltine, too. Well, you may be kind of thin and small. So ask your mother to let you have Ovaltine with all your meals, and pretty soon, just see if you don't begin to get bigger and huskier and have loads more pep than ever before.
Oh, the sponsors. Have more pep, Steve. We need some Ovaltine right here.
I need some Ovaltine
right
every
now.
Day.
Right now. So like you mentioned, a lot of kids didn't like the comic strip version, but they really did like her on the radio.
Now, Sandy, leaping lizards, what's the idea of sitting there begging? I sure am glad you can sit up there and bake today. I'm awful glad it wasn't you, Sandy, that got shot. And I'd feel terrible if anything like that happened to you. Yes, I would. But you don't need to look so pleased about it.
That woman's talking to her dog.
Yep.
Dog is answering.
And ironically, Shirley Bell, who played Annie, was often playing Sandy the dog also during the course of the show. Especially if Sandy was barking. But it's possible that she was in that scene by herself.
Wow.
Nothing like being in a scene by yourself. Now, wow. Modern audiences don't really remember the radio version of Orphan Annie. She was a little bit more like Nancy Drew would be on the radio. We like the Broadway version, the singing, dancing Annie. But if we do remember the Annie that was on the radio, it's because of all the prizes that kids could send away for.
Boy, there's just no end to all the fun you can have with a set of these magic pictures. And best of all, remember, Annie sends them to you absolutely free. But understand, Annie has only a small quantity of these magic transfer pictures. And that means you'll want to write in this very night to make sure of getting your set free.
So the marketing to children during these adventure shows was completely over the top. For one thing, the main characters themselves always endorsed the product. And secondly, announcers would hype these prizes for days in advance. They would say things like, "Now don't forget, we have a very special announcement coming up later this week that you're not going to want to miss." So that by the time the kid actually hears about the Little Orphan Annie decoder ring, they have been waiting to hear what it was going to be for days. And of course they want it. People remember this phenomenon a lot from Gene Shepard, who noted the excitement of having a decoder ring in his movie, A Christmas Story.
Remember, kids, only members of Annie's secret circle can decode Annie's secret message. Here is the message. 12, 11.
I am in my first secret meeting. 12, I could tell that tonight's message was really important.
3, 25. That's a message from Annie herself. Remember, don't tell anyone.
So, let's hear what the decoded message actually was.
My fingers flew. My mind was a steel trap. Every pore vibrated. It was almost clear. Yes, 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 yes.
Be sure to drink your Ovaltine.
Oh, that's just another advertising message.
Not uncommon. So going back to where we started, remember these parenting groups that set out to protect their kids from violence and poor messages by issuing guidelines that directed the adventure shows forgot to protect them from advertising whatsoever. As historian Leonard Moulton put it in his book, The Great American Broadcast, he says, shamelessness in advertising reached its zenith on the adventure shows for children.
Katie, I'd like to stay with you, but I got to go talk to a sponsor about this next segment.
I'm going to go have some Ovaltine.
This is Week Day.
I'm a very lucky boy. I've got a cereal box. And I'm a very lucky girl. I've got a cereal box. All of the kids in the neighborhood say cereal pops are triple good. Triple good.
Okay, it's 66 degrees in Seattle. It is mostly cloudy. We're anticipating showers today. It's going to turn partly sunny later, and we'll probably get up to 72 degrees.
KUOW would like to thank the members of the Broadcasters Circle for their generosity and leadership support throughout the year. For more information on how you can become a Broadcasters Circle member, visit KUOW.org.
10:33. I'm Bernard Ouellette. An update on what's happening in the trial of George Zimmerman, the Florida man charged with killing unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin, in the news at 11.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman, and as I mentioned earlier, former South African President Nelson Mandela is currently on life support in a Pretoria hospital. The 94-year-old Mandela is in critical condition, and although he is a politician and a leader, longtime leader of a political movement, many South Africans are praying because they view him as a beloved family elder. And we were talking about 8 minutes ago with Robert Taylor, who grew up in South Africa. He's the former dean of St. Mark's Episcopal Church. And Robert, we're trying you on a different phone line that will hopefully be a little more clear.
I'm hoping it is, Marcia. Oh, good to be back.
Yeah, good not to have that metallic sound. You mentioned that you really weren't consciously aware of Nelson Mandela until you were a teenager, and I'm assuming that that's also the time when the realities of apartheid became more clear to you as a human.
Oh, absolutely, and I began to be involved in the anti-apartheid movement as a teenager, and then, you know, in my college years, I remember whenever I would be back in Cape Town, I would go up to a place called Signal Hill, which looked out across the bay with a clear view of Robben Island in the distance, the place where Mandela was imprisoned for almost 27 years. And I would sit there and just look and imagine what he was doing and what we were all losing by having him incarcerated in this high-security prison, when his vision for the country seemed so absolutely exciting to me in terms of it really being beyond the sort of tribal politics that you saw in much of Africa, but instead a politics of unity and of oneness in a country who, you know, the government at the time was the very antithesis of those things.
Well, you mentioned he had been in prison for 15 some years by the time you were a teenager, and yet he was still being demonized by the white South African government that was currently in power. So I'm not quite sure how somebody who was isolated from everybody, including his other prisoners, could have that much of an influence.
Well, you know, he managed to get some writings smuggled out of prison, which were published, and there were reports. I mean, there was, a lone and single member of an opposition party in the parliament at the time, whose name was Helen Suzman, whose nephew, in fact, lives in Seattle, and she got regular access to see him, I think, once or twice a year, and she would report on him, and Desmond Tutu would report on him. He would go and visit his then wife, Winnie Mandela, and because she was often under house arrest, he would actually have to talk with her across the fence in her yard. But so news would be spread, and as the divestment movement began in the 70s and college campuses around the U.S. and religious groups got involved in that, I think it served to further highlight Mandela's profile internationally.
You left South Africa under duress, I suppose. You refused to serve in the military. You were, I'm not sure if smuggled out is the correct word, but essentially you left the country. You were helped to leave the country. Where were you when Mandela was released from prison at last?
Well, I remember the day. It was 1990. I was actually leading a church service in Westchester County and a congregation that I served. Couldn't wait for the service to end. I remember giving a very short sermon and probably racing through the service. And I think most of the people in the congregation, who'd chosen to come that morning, wanted to get home and watch their televisions as well, because it was this, you know, absolutely captivating moment that that most people didn't know would ever happen. I think many people assumed that Mandela might die in prison or would only be released in the event of, you know, a violent overthrow of the system. But there was this negotiation that he entered into with the then white president of South Africa, much to the consternation of some of his fellow members of the ANC. But he had come to believe that working together with, you know, one's enemies was, in fact, the only way forward if South Africa was to avert a bloodbath. And so even from prison, he was exercising a new kind of hopeful leadership for the country.
It almost sounds a bit like Gandhi in his view of how to deal with one's enemy.
Yes, and, you know, I was talking actually a while ago with Tutu about that, and you know, he observed that, you know, people often ask the question that, you know, and I think many of your listeners have probably imagined, you know, what would have happened if the world had had Mandela as a full political player without those 27 years imprisonment? And Tutu said, you know, he went to prison as an angry young man. And he said, sometimes we forget that suffering actually leads to transformation, not just for ourselves, but for other people. And he said, out of that hardship, he said, we should never forget that it was the hardship that focused Mandela and his energy in new ways. And, you know, in prison, he essentially ran a leadership university with his fellow members of the ANC, preparing them for the day in which they would perhaps get to rule South Africa. And so he was not, his spirit was not imprisoned by Robben Island. He was, in fact, making a choice to live with a more optimistic and hopeful and proactive way of thinking about both his own role, those who were imprisoned with him, and what might be possible one day.
Robert, you mentioned that you were leading a service in Westchester County, which I think was your first parish out of theological school, and you had been gone from your home country for quite some time at that point. How did you feel personally about the news as a South African, not just as a man concerned about the welfare of Nelson Mandela or the anti-apartheid movement?
Well, just hearing you ask the question, Marcy, brings chills all over my body, because it's as though I'm back in that day. I was filled with complete, you know, disbelief that this was really going to happen. I wondered how real this was, given the draconian tactics of the government. And I cried. I cried tears of just joy and thanksgiving for the very thing that I had hoped for, that so many of us had hoped for, but weren't sure that we would ever actually come to see happen.
And this is a man that you had not at that time met personally. When did you actually get to meet him?
Well, I met him 8 years later, in 1998. One of the great legends in the anti-apartheid movement was a man by the name of Trevor Huddleston, excuse me, and Huddleston had written a book in the 50s, essentially challenging the government and its supposed biblical justifications for the violent racist policies of apartheid. And he was demonized for that and ultimately lived in exile. And Huddleston had died that year, and the official sort of memorial service for him in the U.S. was to take place in New York City. And the service was planned around Mandela's availability because he wanted to travel from South Africa to pay tribute to this gentle and yet fiercely courageous man for his work in the anti-apartheid struggle. And so it was at that service that I participated in that I got to spend some time with him. And I was struck by his very self-effacing manner and a deep sense of humility, and yet the sense that you have when you're in the presence of people like, for me it would be people like the Dalai Lama or Tutu, and this profound sense of being in the presence of somebody who invites the human spirit into the fullness of who we can be.
That helps me a bit to understand the way that South Africans who are currently gathered outside his hospital must feel, because you are describing a spiritual leader as much as a political leader.
Well, I think so, and a sort of spiritual in the sense that transcends any particular, religion. He essentially not only unified a country that many people thought could never be unified, by his constant choices to make human calculations instead of political calculations. Mm. He said on the day he was released, the long march to freedom is irreversible. And when he was in office, and actually prior to him being elected as president in 94, everything that he was about, everything he did, was about that work of bringing people together. And I think it's part of why not only South Africans hold such a revered place for him, but why he's such an international icon when most of the political leaders that we have on, our own local and national stage and many on the global stage are engaged in a tribal politics or a purely partisan politics of some kind. And Mandela holds up this vision for some other way to be.
It's interesting, though, because as you describe Desmond Tutu talking about the angry young man who was sent to prison on Robben Island, had he taken leadership at that point in his life, it doesn't sound that perhaps he might have done the same kind of governing that he was able to do with that horrible experience behind him.
One hopes that would not be true, but I think that that's probably correct. I think one of the points that Tutu made was that that in the midst of the suffering, there is a softening of the edges, and in Mandela's case, a growing curiosity about wanting to understand the Afrikaner people who, for the most part, were the ruling party that enforced apartheid. And, the stories are legendary about how he became friends with the guards who were responsible for him in that high security prison. And in fact, they were there at his inauguration, sitting up front with his family and other dignitaries for his inauguration, which is, sends a remarkable message in and of itself.
When did you finally get to go back to South Africa for the first time?
I went back the end of the year that he was released, so it was December of 1990, and I arrived on the 31st, and there had been a long tradition in South Africa of the media giving all of its, printed media, giving its front page coverage to the message of the state president, and it typically took up the entire front page of the paper. And of course, in my lifetime, that message had always been from the apartheid president. So I arrived in the airport in Johannesburg on the 31st, picked up the newspaper, and there was Mandela's message to the nation with his photograph on the front page And, you know, he had not been elected president at that point, and the message from the president was buried inside the paper, and I thought, wow. When I left, it would have been a treasonable offense to print his words and to display his image. Something has changed. And it was a remarkable first visit back, and I've been fortunate to be able to go back almost every year since then, and sometimes more than once a year, and mark the changes in the country.
So when you look at your home country, I mean, I think you've been here as long as you lived in South Africa.
Oh, longer now, yes.
Yeah. But when you go back, are you able to see visible changes?
Oh, absolutely.
And
It is a significantly different country. You know, people have access to education and to healthcare that they did not have. There is a different energy and spirit in the country. There is a freedom of discussion in spite of a pending bill before the parliament that certainly never existed in the country in the time that I lived there. And, of course, the country has many problems still, and I don't mean to minimize those. And I think what's so striking as the world sort of thinks about Mandela and perhaps prays for the peaceful ending of his life, his leadership stands in sharp contrast to that of the current government. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, significant changes, but still a lot of work to be done in the country.
What will his passing mean? He hasn't held power. He's 94 years old, and he's in terribly ill health right now. But what will it mean to South Africa as a nation and to the people of South Africa?
Well, you know, my hope is that one of the things that might emerge from it is that you've now got a whole new generation of young South Africans who really don't know Mandela because, you know, they were born when, you know, he was perhaps released from prison or and he's not been as much a part of their consciousness. So my hope is that one of the gifts of his passing will be a renewed inquisitiveness about what has made him such a national and global iconic figure. Because I think he has lessons in his leadership and just in his way of being and the choices that he has made as a human being about how to be in the world and how to be a leader that I think are universal and I think that the world is so hungry for.
And to you personally, what will his passing mean?
You know, I have a profound sense of sadness and impending sadness as I think about his passing. I've been in New York this week for meetings and I happened to pass by a phone booth. I didn't know that phone booths still existed in New York. And that in and of itself was quite quaint. And on the side of it was this huge picture of Nelson Mandela. And underneath it, it said, "What can one person do?" And then underneath that in red and white, it said, "Inspiration, pass it on." And I think for me and hopefully for many of us, probably the greatest way in which to honor and express our love and affection and profound gratitude for such a remarkable life is to ask how we can be a part of passing even a portion of that on.
Robert Taylor is the former dean of St. Mark's Cathedral in Seattle, author of the book A New Way to Be Human, A Native South African. Robert, thanks for sharing these thoughts with us.
It's so good to be with you, Marcy. Thank you.
And inspiration, pass it on. This is Weekday on KUOW. It is Thursday, the day that we check in with food writer Sarah Dickerman. And Sarah, you are going very European on us today. We've lost Sarah. Well, we'll get Sarah back in just a minute. Sarah Dickerman is our food writer. She joins us Thursdays on KUOW.
In In the meantime, why don't I tell you a little something about the weather? 66 degrees in Seattle right now. It's cloudy. We're looking at showers today. It's going to wind up partly sunny later with a continuing chance of showers and a high of 72. And then starting tomorrow, Friday, it's going to be mostly sunny with temperatures up in the high 70s, low 80s, all the way through Wednesday. It's 10:52, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
And now it's time to check in with Sarah Dickerman. Now you're here, right? Nope, not there. We keep losing Sarah Dickerman, so I can...
How do we know what to eat for lunch?
I have no idea how we'll know what to eat for lunch.
Let's try this. Sarah, are you there?
I am.
Okay, good. Now
I'm
you're
here.
Now you're there. Okay.
I took a journey, but I'm back.
To Europe, right? You went to Europe.
I just went over the line. I must have been going to imaginary Berlin because I am going to talk about a couple of sandwich shops that are doing Turkish style sandwiches in the. But in the manner that you might have them in Berlin.
That is a very particular thing. It's called the Berliner, right?
Yes, it's called the Berliner. And I've been to the Pioneer Square one a few times. There's also one in South Lake Union. And it's a kind of wonderful sort of sandwich that I've missed. There used to be a great Turkish doner place on Broadway in a mini mart. It was called Bistro Antalya, and it just sort of disappeared one day, sadly, after an INS raid. And so I haven't had a doner sandwich in a while until the Berliner opened again. And it's basically a sort of fat pita that's been sliced open, maybe more like a focaccia bread. And then the meat is cooked over a spit, a rotating spit like you have, you know, like a gyro. And you can get either lamb or chicken. And then it's topped with all sorts of wonderful, very fresh-tasting ingredients, like garlicky yogurt sauce, cucumber, tomato, onion, some red cabbage, and cilantro. So it's got this wonderful combination of the richness of the meat and this almost salad-y.
Well, it sounds very Middle Eastern rather than German. So is this different than a Turkish sandwich would be in Turkey?
You know, I haven't been to Turkey, so I'm not entirely sure. But I think the idea is there's so many Turkish immigrants in Berlin that it's become sort of a beloved street food there as well. And so there's maybe a little more freedom of what you put on the sandwich and maybe a little less pinned to tradition.
Well,
also a variation that has, you know, very, very hot sauce that they call the fiery Kreuzberg with chili sauce and a similar, you know, same fixings that you can get, but with a much spicier take. And then there's a version that has mango and a little yogurt curry sauce on it. So maybe that's why they refer to the Berlin idea.
What if you don't eat meat?
It's actually a really nice place for vegetarians, I think. They have this one tofu sandwich, the mango and curry yogurt one, and then on any of the combinations you can get tofu, and if you eat dairy you can get feta, or you can skip the feta. So it's a nice place for, I think, a lot of different people down in Pioneer Square, often lots of people working down there, and or if you're just traveling around checking out the scene, it's a great place to stop by.
It's called the Berliner. You are also going European on us as far as a cookbook recommendation.
Yes, that's right. I thought I'd go classic this time, and I'm recommending Elizabeth David's French Provincial Cooking, which is just a sort of classic of the genre. And she was a very well-traveled British writer who spent time living in France and Italy, Greece, and Egypt. And she really brought this idea of cooking seasonally, cooking the freshest ingredients you could and treating them quite simply to Britain, and inspired a lot of British cooks as well as American cooks. I know she's a touchstone for Alice Waters of Chez Panisse here in this country. And a lot of the sort of West Coast Mediterranean cooks that we love and appreciate here refer to Elizabeth David.
So it's essentially about using fresh local ingredients and simplicity?
Yes, simplicity, but, you know, a sort of heightened version of it. You know, she's great with egg dishes and savory tarts. She's just sort of a wonderful writer on salads and sort of the aesthetic of a salad and using care as you prepare things as well. And then the other pleasurable thing is that with each recipe, there's often a story of where she's traveled or the people she had encountered who inspired her. And she's just a, you know, as the British are so often such good, slightly sometimes funny, and very, they have a precision to their writing that I find really satisfying. So she's a wonderful writer and will make you want to travel as well as cook.
I'm going to read the sentence that you sent to us. This is about salads. The dressing should, however, taste predominantly of olive oil when the salad has been turned gently over and over and over in the dressing. The best way to do it is with your hands so that every leaf is coated with its film of oil. Serve it at once, fresh, green, and shining. I love that. A shiny salad to you, Sarah Dickerman. Thanks for sharing those with us.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Dickerman writes about food for Salon, Bon Appetit, and other publications. You can find her at her website, sarahdickerman.com, and on Twitter, at Sarah Dickerman. And she's here every Thursday on Weekday, which is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is the valiant man who's been juggling missing phone calls and all sorts of things. I'm Marcy Silman. Join Katie Sewell tomorrow. Steve Duno will be in answering your pet questions, plus our panel of journalists will be here as well on KUOW.
They're still hammering out the details on the budget in Olympia. What's the holdup? KUOW's Lisa Brooks has the story in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Ticket scalping puts the good seats out of reach for many concertgoers. They're not the only ones unhappy about it. Take Kid Rock, for example.
I'm tired of seeing the old rich guy in the front row with the hot girlfriend with her beer in the air just screaming the whole time, and the old rich guy standing there like he could care less.
The economics of ticket scalping, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Clipper Vacations, offering daily trips and overnight packages to Victoria, B.C., and whale-watching day trips to the San Juan Islands. Information on these and many other Pacific Northwest getaways are online at clippervacations.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:59. This is a test of the emergency alert system. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.